One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the 117 Experts Can't Be Wrong edition. I'm Shane Harris of The Daily Beast. I like to think of myself as an expert, but I am not one of these 117 experts we'll be talking about today.
No, but now the question is, if there are 117 experts and you're not one of them, does that now make you not like all of us? Because does that make us not experts?
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those things where they say like 9 out of 10 dentists approve this toothpaste, but you don't use it. What's wrong with you?
You need a new dentist.
What is wrong with you, Shane?
I've been asking this question for a long time. Many, many people have asked that question. We're all here in our Sylvan studio. It's a lovely day in Washington, D.C. It feels like summer, almost. It feels springy.
Springy.
It's not
the
hot
cherry
like
trees are starting to pop.
Yeah, it's
that
a little
DC
early.
Thing.
It's a little early right now. But yeah, I'm here with Benjamin Wittes. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
Tamara Kaufman Wittes. Hello, Tamara.
Hello, Shane.
And once again, Susan Hennessy, who we are proud to announce is officially joining the Rational Security podcast as a permanent member panelist.
Welcome to our merry band.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we need
I'm
a song.
Very delighted.
And we're going to have, Helen Klein periodically try to fake you guys out
yeah.
and pretend to be Susan Hennessy.
We should do the podcast blindfolded one day and see if we can tell.
Who's Susan?
If it's Susan or her sister. Yeah.
And also if we can tell the difference between Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi.
And
Coke Zero.
Yeah.
We should have an all blindfold edition.
Let's do it. Sometimes it feels that way already.
This is getting kinky, guys.
Maybe
that'll be our 50 Shades of Rational.
That
may
be our end of year special.
That may be our end of series episode.
The blindfold edition.
Shut it down.
The blind leading the blind edition. Oh, well, today on the podcast, we're going to get to those 117 experts. They were more than 100 Republican national security experts who declared in an open letter that Donald Trump is unfit to be president. Who would actually serve or advise a President Trump? And President Obama, you remember him, pulls back the curtain on the inner workings of his foreign policy in a lengthy article, lengthy interview with The Atlantic. Why don't we get started with, I'll kick off my wordplay. So this astonishing, I think, fair to say, letter, was it published on War on the Rocks, or did they just have it?
It was published, they did.
It was published on War on the Rocks. Okay, we should give them credit for that. Great site, great podcast, actually, too. We, the undersigned members of the Republican National Security Community, I guess they could have said establishment in this letter.
By definition.
By definition. Mm-hmm. We are represent a broad spectrum of opinion on America's role and what is necessary to keep us safe and prosperous. You probably have read this letter if you're listening to this podcast. Ends by saying, goes on to list a litany of things that make Donald Trump, in their words, I love this, unfitted to the office of president. I like that. It's like you bought him off the rack.
Yeah.
He's unfit.
You tried him on. He doesn't fit.
We tried to measure him. He doesn't work. The highlights.
I caught that reference.
Did you like that?
Yeah. That was very subtle.
Thank you. Appreciate that. His embrace and expansive use of torture is inexcusable, they say.
I like that it's the expansive use of torture.
Right. Expansive.
It's not the
torture. The limited use of torture might be fine.
A little bit of torture nobody has a problem with, but
Playing
the expansive
people, not okay.
use of torture is unacceptable.
Yeah. His admiration for foreign dictators such as Vladimir Putin is unacceptable for the leader of the world's greatest democracy. He has said very nice things about Vladimir Putin after he said very nice things about Trump. He is fundamentally dishonest. His equation of business acumen with foreign policy expertise is false. Not all lethal conflicts can be resolved as a real estate deal might, and there is no recourse to bankruptcy court in international affairs.
That's a sick burn.
Yeah. That is pretty good, too. This is a pretty stunning letter. I will offer it to the group if you've ever seen anything like this or are aware in contemporary times of so many people rising up with one voice. We should say, by the way, signatories keep being added to this letter.
Who knew there were so many members of the Republican foreign policy establishment?
What is the criteria for getting to sign the letter?
They're all here.
Right?
In terms of have you ever seen anything like it, 2 days before it ran, I actually wrote something kind of like it, but it just represented only me.
Yeah.
And it's an
article. Yeah, and you're a closet Republican anyway.
Yeah,
so.
I'm sort of not a Republican.
But the opposite of a rhino.
It was an article that actually itself channeled something else that was kind of like this, which was an article that John Bellinger wrote on Lawfare in December, saying that Trump, we should think about Trump as a threat to national security.
Which is what you called him. Yeah.
Well, right. So then I took that article and kind of ran with it, and I tried to imagine all the elements of Trumpism, which include the ones that they mention in that letter and a bunch of others, and is a little bit less hortatory and more analytical, but sort of like why we should think about Trump as a national security threat, not merely if he were president, but even as a candidate,
as the nominee.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I do think what the War on the Rocks people are, so first of all, they were clearly working on this before my piece ran. They couldn't have had as many signatures as they had in that period of time.
I don't know, Ben, you're pretty influential.
But my gut is that a lot of people were thinking in the same direction right around the same time, that hey, now that we have to take this Trump thing seriously, you know, we should think about it in the language of how dangerous it would be for the United States if this is, if this were really the nominee. But look, the answer to your question is Bellinger was way out ahead of the
curve. Sure. I don't mean I'm pressing like this article, but like, I mean, as in ganging up on this candidate. Have we ever seen that before?
Yeah, it is. I do think that's unprecedented. Not, that foreign policy experts have never ganged up on any presidential candidates, but to see this wide range of people identifying themselves with a particular party ganging up on the front runner for that party. I think that's what's unprecedented. I also think the language is so intemperate. I mean, it's not hedged at all. It's quite extraordinary and almost to the point where it's a bit over the top. I mean, look, I think that there are a lot of reasons to question Trump's temperament. I think there's a lot of reason to question his understanding of world affairs, and to question his judgment. But I hesitate to say that the showman we see on our television screens night after night is necessarily the guy that would be same as the guy that would be sitting in the Oval Office. While I'm certainly willing to look at his mercantilist impulses, his egocentrism, and these other dimensions of his character that do seem fairly consistent, and worry about their consequences for American foreign policy, I don't think it's like mad dog in the White House,
But I think that this is, it's that bombastic thing that they are a little bit chafing against, right? It's that, these are serious times for serious people. This stuff is scary. It's real. These are people that have hands-on experience. They understand the consequences of getting it wrong. And so I think that part of this is them sort of really wanting to come out in the strongest possible terms and say, look, this is not a show. This is not a game. This is not, your mail order steak business. This is the United States of America, and this is the world. And I think these are people who all, certainly Democrats as well, but, this group of people, they take this work really seriously. They take their commitments to the institution, to the rule of law really seriously. And so I think it is, offensive and also sort of deeply threatening to them. To sort of see someone who is so cavalier about this stuff. I think that's the thing where you start to get really freaked out because, the one thing that sort of binds everyone in this community, sort of across the political spectrum together, is an understanding of how high stakes this is. And I think that's the reason why the national security community has been able to sort of break through some of the partisan stuff, right? Because the stakes are so high, the consequences are so grave, that behind closed doors, the rhetoric tends to be much more tempered. You see a lot more collaboration. So, frankly, I'm surprised it didn't come earlier, right? It's kind of a little too late at this point.
Well, it's insightful that you note that this is maybe less about this group of Republican foreign policy people being terrified and more about their being offended. And I think that explains a letter that not only the way it's written, but the timing of it, it's clearly not about having impact on the nomination process. It's not designed to persuade the American voter or even to persuade party elders. It is a statement of principle.
But maybe it's also
something else. I think it's also designed to give cover to a lot of people who are then going to turn around and support Hillary.
And that's an interesting point.
And I think, you know, I jokingly tweeted the other day that Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan should be "an adult and not insane."
Wow, that's a low bar.
Well, it is a low bar.
It's catchy.
But with the possible exception of John Kasich, she's the only one right now who kind of obviously clears it. And there are a lot of people in the world who really hate Hillary Clinton, who are having to contemplate the possibility of voting for her merely because she meets those two basic criteria. And to have her, and to have documents out there that say the other, 117 people from my own party regard this guy as unacceptable as a national security matter to be president of the United States, gives people in that group and elsewhere something to point to that says, okay, there's a higher reason than partisan politics to support Hillary.
And so my question ultimately then, and maybe this gets at it, is does this letter matter? Right. I mean, does this letter and matter to whom is, I guess, one way of putting it. But does it matter that these people, is this going to change anything that 117 and counting people have now come out in this extraordinary way, whatever their motivations, and essentially are trying to persuade people not to elect this man?
So I don't think that they necessarily are going to persuade anyone not to elect him, but I do think they might be persuading people not to advise him.
Mm. Yeah.
Don't
make him a better candidate on foreign policy. Just let him
hoist
himself on his own petard.
And there might be consequences within your own peer group if you decide to legitimize this candidate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of which,
that leads very well to your wordplay, Ben.
Yeah, that's a great segue. Thank you, Susan.
Ben knows segues.
Yes, it's a great segue. It is now, by the way, I want to point out that it's segue weather again.
Here we go again.
Segue, have you?
It's Ben with a segue season, ladies and gentlemen.
Segue season is back.
Streets are not safe.
And by the way, if anybody wants to come on a Segway tour through the cherry blossoms, it may have to happen in the next few days.
Yeah.
So I read this really interesting piece in the Daily Beast by some reporter I'd never heard of before. About
no one's ever heard of
Harris
guy?
Harris.
Nobody.
Sean Harris.
Devastatingly handsome. Incredibly insightful.
That's true. And it was a piece about the one prominent intelligence national security guy who seems to be advising Trump. And that is former DIA chief General Flynn. Whom I had not previously known to be insane. And
by the way, for the record, according to him, a registered Democrat.
Right. Wow, that just makes it so perfect.
Yeah.
I don't even understand.
What do we know about General Flynn? Is he an isolationist?
Well, I don't know that much about him, except that he ran DIA. He gave a speech at Brookings not all that long ago.
He was pushed out a year ahead of time at DIA. He was controversial.
But he does seem to be... Now, is it clear that he's supporting Trump?
Just to kind of recap a little bit from the article, I mean, he has acknowledged to advising him. He uses the word informally, but then he does not elaborate on what formally versus informally means.
It's that's like really... that guy you dated in college that won't call you his girlfriend.
It's, no, it's exactly like that.
You're hanging
it's
out.
It's exactly that. No, that's exactly what it is.
I really enjoy spending time with yeah. you.
But, like, you wouldn't, like, then you say girlfriend or boyfriend and they, like, slowly back out of the room.
Right.
It's that.
And, like, okay. behind the scenes, I've heard, you know, people who know him and who've been in a room with him and hearing him talk about Trump who said that, you know, he's spoken admiringly, you know, Flynn has spoken admiringly of Trump. And, you know, he's also, for the record, met with Ted Cruz. But it's not clear from my reporting that the Cruz relationship is anywhere sort of as developed as the Trump relationship.
So here's my question. I mean, which of Trump's, you know, crazy, bombastic statements about intelligence should we attribute to the advice that he's received?
That we should be torturing people?
And we should do far more than waterboarding?
Yeah.
Is that general Flynn?
We should behead the families of terrorists?
No.
Go after.
Go after. Because they're beheading people. So right. we should be worse than
that. Maybe General Flynn's advice was to bomb the shit out of ISIS's oil installation. Yeah. I mean, which part of Trumpism should we actually think that reflects the advice of General Flynn?
But guys, can I just say, like, as somebody who was publicly identified for a day as supposedly advising Bernie Sanders.
We should give you an opportunity to say, is that true, Tamara?
Tim, why? Are you a current advisor to Bernie Sanders?
Why, no. Where do these things come from? You know, part of my job, and I would think that part of what most former senior national security officials would see as their civic responsibility, is answering calls that come from prominent individuals with policy interests, helping them understand issues and consulting with them. And that doesn't mean that you support them or that you're advising them. So I met with Bernie Sanders once. He was a senator. He wanted to talk about ISIS, and I talked to him about ISIS because I think that's part of my job, but that doesn't mean that I'm advising his campaign. I am explicitly not.
Is there a campaign that you are advising?
Are you with anyone, Tammy?
Yes, I think it is. I believe I have disclosed publicly on the podcast before, but I am advising Hillary Clinton's campaign. I think that in the press, and I'd love your perspective on this, Shane, there's a hunt for advisors for all these candidates. There's lots of gossip always, and there are always lots of meetings going on,
right.
always. And so, Flynn's being cagey, is that because he doesn't want to confirm or he doesn't want to deny or because he isn't really sure yet? I don't know how significant it is.
I do think it gets to sort of a larger question, not just as Trump becomes sort of the presumptive nominee, but certainly if he's elected president, and that is what is the moral obligation? A huge part of, certainly in the national security community, although I'd imagine, the foreign policy community as well, is built on individual trust relationships that sort of, that transcend partisanship, right? It's people
sure.
that, in a professional environment where other people necessarily know things that you don't know and you know things that they don't know, knowing somebody is an honest broker, a smart person, someone whose judgment you trust, that's immensely important. It's just, it's kind of how the trains run on time, how there's continuity across administration.
Well, and isn't it also a mark of leadership to recognize what you don't know and reach out to people who do know it?
Exactly. So the question becomes, if someone is elected who is unfit, who is a dangerous to the institution, do you view yourself as a guardian, right? That you are there to preserve the rule of law, to defend, massively powerful and potentially really quite dangerous national security tools? Or do you say, I don't want to be a part of this, right? So in deciding who to advise, what is the obligation of the responsible policymaker, the responsible lawyer?
So a couple things. One is, once somebody is elected, you may well have a civic obligation to, quite apart from who's holding the office, to serve the office, partly to protect certain tools from the occupant of the office. I know one person who was asked to, I have to be very cagey about how I say this, to be chief of staff to somebody that he didn't think should be in office, and agreed to do it, and his first piece of advice to the person was resign.
Wow.
And 6 weeks later, gave him the same advice again. And so, you know, sometimes there is a civic obligation to hold positions for unsavory, inappropriate people because they shouldn't be in the offices that they are in. And I think Trump, if he were elected, I think would put a lot of people in that position, you know, of thinking about what's the right posture for me with respect to this person and the office in question. On the other hand, I don't think that holds when the person's a candidate. My view is, you know, in my Brookings capacity, I will talk to any candidate and I will provide, or their staff, I will provide the same advice, you know, the same policy guidance that I can give to anybody on an equal basis, Republican or Democrat, candidate, office holder. That said, you know, if Donald Trump came to me and said, you know, I want your advice on ISIS, I would start with, change the entire way you talk about the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. You're endangering the national security of the United States.
So you would advise him not so much to help him as much as to tell him like it is and to try to correct what you see as his mistakes.
I would say you have poisoned the ability of the United States to engage with the Muslim world. The first thing you need to do is publicly apologize. The second thing you should do is remove yourself from the conversation. And that would be, you know, and I'm not sure why anybody, particularly a former DIA head who has presumably some insight into the impact of U.S. behavior in attitudes in parts of the world with which we need to engage. I'm not sure what business General Flynn has telling Donald Trump anything other than,
well,
look, sir, you know, with all due respect, you suck.
I think I can answer that question, which is I would direct people to Michael Flynn's Twitter feed, where, among other things, he has tweeted recently. Let me just pull this up real quick. Fear of Muslims is rational.
Wow.
Linking to a tweet from his...
So there you go.
Linking to a tweet, a video that says, that a video that purports to reveal, quote-unquote, the basics of Islam, and argues that, quote, the term Islamophobia is an oxymoron, since having a phobia means having an irrational fear. Fearing Islam, which wants 80% of humanity enslaved or exterminated, is totally rational. He then retweeted a photo of a woman named Brigitte.
A meeting of the minds.
So there we go. So now we have the answer to Ben's question, which is all of it.
He's an Islamophobe.
Just some hateful, gross.
Yeah, there was also, he retweeted a photo of a woman named Brigitte Gabriel, who's the founder of Act for America, which is an advocacy group dedicated to, in its words, fighting radical Islam's attempts to infiltrate and take over the West, calling her an incredibly courageous person. It was a photograph of her standing at Mar-a-Lago, where she claimed to be giving a national security briefing, and quote, look who I bumped into,
and
it was
there
Donald Trump.
We go.
So that may be another...
The circle is complete.
Right.
His foreign policy advice comes from Brigitte Gabriel and General Flynn.
Yeah.
And now all is clear.
But the important thing in terms of the world of advising candidates is, who advised Bernie Sanders to wear a brown suit?
Oh, brown suits are terrible.
No one? You guys didn't watch the
You know, I think Bernie Sanders just owns the old Brooklyn Grandpa thing, and he might as well rock the suit that goes with it. I have no problem with that.
I cannot defend the brown suit.
Does the brown suit have national security implications?
Potentially.
If people are offended by brown or scared by brown.
Do you remember how much crap President Obama got for wearing a brown suit? What's the problem?
I just want to one last question before we wrap this up. A question you had, which I thought was a really good one. About, you know, the question of the significance of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly right. I mean, like, you know, at some point, Donald Trump presumably will put out officially on paper a list of people who are...
Which he's been promising to do for 6 months.
That's the thing. And that's what I was going to get as why, you know, the sort of the hunt for it and the interest in it, I think, is because he's the front runner and he has consistently both made extreme statements about foreign policy and national security issues and consistently refused to say who he's actually getting advice from. The question has been, you know, is anyone actually advising you or are you just making this up as you go along? And he actually came out the other day and started praising Richard Haass as someone he liked. And it wasn't clear if it was like, well, you're not saying Richard Haass is advising you.
Actually, Richard Haass responded on Twitter very quickly saying,
No.
By the way, as president of the Council on Foreign Relations, I don't advise any candidates by policy. But also Richard Haass is sort of the antithesis of the kind of viewpoints that Trump's been espousing.
It struck also, I mean, not to be too cynical about it, but as Donald Trump sort of being put on the spot and going, think of a name, quick. Think, Richard Haass, I've seen him on TV. He's good. Anyway, I watch the shows.
Maybe this is the answer. He watches the shows.
No, he said that.
He
says that, those words.
Like all Americans, he learns by watching the Sunday talk shows.
You should say John Dickerson is one of his advisors.
Because he's listened to Whistle Stop.
Yeah, that's a great podcast. I love John Dickerson.
Shout out to John Dickerson's Whistle Stop podcast, which is genuinely worth a half an hour of your time every time.
It is so worth so much more than trying to figure out who's advising Trump on foreign policy.
What I'd like to figure out is how John Dickerson has time to do what he does, which is host Face the Nation, do the Slate podcast, do Whistle Stop. You know, he has another like shadow podcast. It's like 3 minutes a day where he just like speaks into a mic. It's a campaign diary.
Maybe he just has a mic with him all the time. Maybe he does these while he's walking down the street and
just like talking
in the shower.
To himself.
I'm gonna be John Dickerson when I grow up. Tamara, you have a lengthy wordplay.
I have a pretty heavy wordplay. It's a magazine article, but boy, when you put it down on the table, it goes thunk. So this is a piece
Let's actually hear that.
Okay.
Tammy's going to drop the article.
Oh! Now, what is this tome of which we speak? It dropped this morning. It's a Jeffrey Goldberg cover story for the upcoming Atlantic magazine. A long, 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 I mean about 15 or 18,000 words, article called The Obama Doctrine, The President Explains His Hardest Decisions About America's Role in the World. And I have to say, I think it's the kind of journalism that Jeffrey Goldberg really excels at, which is just spending hours and hours with a head of state. He did one, an article like this on King Abdullah a couple of years ago, with a head of state really learning their worldview, learning the way they work with their advisors, talking through with them their really tough decision points, and giving all of us a lot of insight into how that person's mind works when it comes to foreign policy. And I think that this is an incredibly revealing article. I commend it to all of you, although you need to sit down and read it when you've got like a couple hours to spare. A few things jump out at me, and I should say that I was asked by The Atlantic, along with a whole slew of other interesting people, to write a short response, which will go up on the Atlantic.com website in the next day or two. And shout out, by the way, to Kathy Gilsonen, editor at Atlantic.com and podcast listener. Thanks, Kathy, for listening. So a few things jump out at me from this piece. The first is how entirely unrepentant Obama is about all of his major foreign policy decisions, whether it's the pivot to Asia or the decision not to enforce his red line on Syrian chemical weapons, and so on. Even the one that he says very explicitly, it didn't work, which is the intervention into Libya, he doesn't repent it. He just says it doesn't work, it didn't work, and he explains why he thinks that was. But the Obama that emerges from this piece is an Obama that is, number one, just relentlessly focused on not repeating the mistakes of his predecessor, learning the lessons of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and avoiding, the same in a way that I think led him into other errors. But the other thing that really strikes me is this is an Obama that is focused on seizing opportunities, much more interested in pursuing opportunities in world affairs than in dealing with the crises that inevitably erupt. He's much better at persistence in the face of all the tumult of global politics than at adaptation when circumstances change, even when they change radically. And he's very, very firm on the principles that guide his choices, much more firm on that than he is on the necessity of choice in a messy world. And for reasons that I'll explain in my little contribution to the debate, I think that leads him into a set of errors that he and we in the United States will have to live with for quite a long time. But I think it's just a fascinating look at a guy who calls himself a realist at some points in the article, calls himself a liberal interventionist at some points in the article, and is really seen struggling with the issue of the use of force and where it fits in American foreign policy.
So my first reaction when I saw this piece was coming out was, great, the Obama doctrine, just in time for him to leave the presidency.
Yeah, now we
right.
get it.
Right. And hearing you describe it, you know, and I haven't read it, but I've seen some of the highlights that were put out last night, is, you know, there is no doctrine. I mean, you can't be all these things. Like, there's no consistency in that.
But isn't the doctrine, in fact, the one that Bernie Sanders is talking about openly? Bernie Sanders says, you know, we have to think hard about the unintended consequences of every overseas action. And while I'm not opposed to interventionism in certain limited cases, the bar is very high. And he doesn't speak a language of liberal interventionism. He speaks a language of extreme caution, let the world go to hell if it doesn't involve us. And Obama, in fact, talks a different language, but actually, if you burrow down in his decision-making, he, in fact, reflects almost exactly what Bernie Sanders professes.
So there is a doctrine, but he's just having trouble articulating it himself.
Right, and like anyone, you know, anyone who's looking at the Republicans right now and thinking that they are the only sort of group struggling for the soul of their party really needs to look at Bernie Sanders' comments on Libya, Bernie Sanders' comments on Syria, and needs to ask themselves whether or not responsibility to protect is a progressive value. If it's not, there is some serious soul searching that needs to be done.
Because he's not advocating intervention in Syria.
No, in fact, he's saying it's a bad idea. And I think that it's not, I mean, you're right about the debate over responsibility to protect, but I think there's a prior question that's being fiercely debated on the progressive side of the political spectrum, which is about the nature of intervention. Is it possible for the United States to use force in a limited way? Or is, you know, or as Sanders contends, and I think Obama largely contends over the course of this article, is every use of force a potential slippery slope to an Iraq war style, open-ended, bottomless American military commitment? There's, you know, and oftentimes I think we've seen people on the progressive side make a straw man argument about this, but you see Sanders in his Libya and Syria comments really playing it out in a much more detailed way. And Obama clearly feeling like his choice not to intervene in Syria was the right one, because if he had, we would be mired in another war in the Middle East right now. And to me, the irony is that, of course, we are. It is a war that Obama chose. It's just not one that he is acknowledging is a war.
Right, and I think it also goes to the importance of advisors, because whenever you look back at Libya and you see him having advisors like Samantha Power, author of Problem from Hell, sort of deeply committed to some of those principles and versed in some of the consequences of failing to make a choice, you really can see how strong committed advisors can change, significant outcomes. I mean, and what happens as those people move in and out?
Yeah, that people matter in policy. Absolutely. I think the other thing, and the article goes into this at some length, is about the opportunities and the priorities that the Obama administration set for itself and didn't allow itself to be distracted from despite all the topics we discuss in this podcast on a regular basis, which is, you know, the opportunity to build a new kinds of coalitions in East Asia that strengthen American interests there and help support what Obama would say is the peaceful rise of China as a global power, the effort to combat climate change. And these are messy problems that require multilateral solutions and American leadership. And I think that those are also major components of what progressives see as their foreign policy agenda.
So one note on this, I commend to all of our listeners an essay by on lawfare by Ammar Abdulhamid about the dangerous and misleading disparity between the liberal interventionist rhetoric of the Obama administration, including Samantha Power and Obama himself, and the reality that is much more realist or anti-interventionist. And he, Ammar's piece, which I thought was quite moving, which is called Is Syria Obama's Fault, really takes them to task for that disparity of rhetoric and says, you know, when you talk that way, as they did about, you know, responsibility to be involved, responsibility to protect, people in Syria heard that and relied on it and believed it. And, you know, it's different from when Henry Kissinger, it behaves like a realist because everybody prices that into, you know, he doesn't use moral rhetoric. And so Ammar's view of it really is that Obama engaged in something of a bait and switch and bears a lot of responsibility for the reliance interest that he created among people who believed that America would be behind them.
Tara, does Obama talk at all in the article about who might come next and replace him in the White House and what they're inheriting and what they might do differently? I mean, any kind of view ahead, because, I mean, somebody could come in and radically change his policy.
It's true. It's mostly a retrospective. There is a section of the article that talks about Obama's focus and his White House team's focus right now on handing off a clean slate. and this is used as a way of explaining their focus on defeating ISIS. I really have to ask how realistic it is for the administration to think that it can hand off an anti-ISIS campaign as some kind of mopping up operation in January 2017. I think that's pretty unrealistic, but that's really the only forward-looking component.
Yeah. Okay. Well, check it out this weekend when you have an afternoon.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's going to be a really great article. all right, let's move on to object lessons. I'll go first, speaking of things you might want to do on your weekend.
You have a high bar to clear in terms of beating your object from last week.
What was my object last week?
The response to your FOIA request on
totally.
That was awesome.
Can you beat that? Top that, Shane.
See if I can actually beat the response.
have you filed your appeal yet?
I'm crafting my appeal.
Okay. We want a dramatic reading.
Eagerly awaiting the outcome.
Yeah. So I'm this is going to sound like a plug, but it's fine. So season 4 of House of Cards has premiered. And this is what I recommend it, not because I like the show.
Now, wait a minute, Shane. Were you at the premiere
National Portrait Gallery? I have some friends who worked
there. Did you see the man himself, President Underwood?
I did. I saw him in character and out of character.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's impressive.
You lead a charmed life, Mr. Harris.
It's true.
It's
not easy.
What a life.
Will House of Cards tweet this episode?
Who knows? They might. But I commend it to listeners only not because you may like the show, but without giving too much away, the FISA court plays a major part in the plot of this season of House of Cards.
Wow.
Which was stunning.
Security on TV.
Yes.
And I just had to
I'm sure they'll get it totally right. Nuance.
They undoubtedly read the seminal Legal Times article in the mid-90s in which the first journalist visited the FISA court.
The first. It's the only.
Are you?
I am the only journalist who's ever been inside the FISA court. And when the Justice Department And the administrative office created a rule that they weren't going to let anybody else in afterwards. The then public affairs officer, John Russell, now alas deceased, called me and said, "Well, Winnis, you have the eternal exclusive."
That's great. Well, Ben, you should definitely watch it. There is actually a scene in the FISA court, which it looks like a courtroom in the D.C. Superior Courthouse. And like the judge at one point looks at the lawyer and says, "Approach the bench." I'm like, they don't think
they don't do that. Yeah.
But still, I mean, it's dramatic. But I have to say, and I'm not going to give anything away, but the reason that it plays in and this sort of scheme that gets developed is so like amazingly, wildly improbable, except in the world of House of Cards, and is like so crazy and illegal. It's just great. National security, like you will love what they just like. They just took
again,
that and they were like, "Oh, what if the president did this?"
Theory.
It's great. Yes. It's just really, it's delightful.
But I think Lawfare clearly has to do a fact check on their presentation of
totally.
Think about all the times we had to have conversations in the last election about 24 scenarios from the television show, 24 and candidates needing to respond to that. Now we're going to have a whole another conversation.
I don't know. I'm a big believer in like accuracy doesn't matter so much in these things. It's just dramatic consistency is what matters.
Well,
and this is a dramatically consistent choice. I will say that for President Underwood.
I was not planning to watch this season's House of Cards.
You should.
But now I think I may have
I think you got to, Ben. The world needs your review.
I've been working my way through London Spy.
Oh, it's so good.
Which is fabulous.
Yeah, that was my other recommendation. Okay. Ben, do you have an object you'd like to share with the class?
I have a brief object. This is a two-part object, this week's part and next week's part. This week, the Wittes family is renting a car.
Wait, a minivan.
A minivan, or an SUV, to drive 11 hours to Kentucky to pick up a rescue puppy. And so my item this week, which
is the gas guzzler we're going to be carting across the country, contributing to climate change.
And I just want to point out the idea of packing four Wittes's in a car together with two dogs to drive 22 hours round trip. Uh-huh.
This is going to go well.
It's very exciting.
It clearly has national security implications.
If you hear an explosion somewhere on the turnpike.
It's not ISIS. It's us.
Oh yeah, you're essentially in a glass and metal cage.
Yes.
With two teenagers and two dogs. Uh-huh. What could go wrong?
And a gas tank full of flammable material. Uh-huh. Assuming this week's object lesson does not end in a fiery disaster, next week's object lesson will be a puppy.
Do we have a name?
No.
Okay. To be determined.
All right. It's going to be hard to top
heavily
Fergie
litigated
as a name.
That's, yes.
Okay. We eagerly await.
Tamara, is your object also the puppy?
How could it be otherwise?
Wow, well, that's it's, nice.
It's
this puppy's
all in.
What
on
kind
the
of
puppy
is it going to be?
A mutt.
All right. That's nice.
You're going all the way to Kentucky for a mutt.
Doesn't Google do this for you?
It's a rescue mutt.
Okay. It's a long story.
All right, but this is the dog crossing the world. All right.
And we're bringing the current dog to meet him. So.
Do you think there's any chance to get to Kentucky, look at the dog, and be like,
No. I will just say that the process of deciding to drive to Kentucky in order to introduce the current dog to the new dog and explore whether this is the new shape of our family, it was the result of extensive multilateral negotiations, and I think really brought Ben and me to the next level in our preparedness for major foreign policy and diplomatic engagements.
Right. I mean,
we have dealt with the Wittes children about this. You know, we can negotiate anything with Putin now.
Oh,
there
yeah,
you go.
You're
yeah.
totally prepped.
It'll be huge.
Huge.
Do you have an object?
I do not.
Okay, well, we'll cut that
How can
out.
I top a puppy?
That's
I'm not
okay.
even going to try.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of the show. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find links to our archive and our past shows at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. And also, when you download the podcast, please leave a rating and a review. We really appreciate it. The podcast is edited, as always, by Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Donald Trump in the brown suits.
Oh!
Brown shirt.
Oh, I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay, so speaking of Sophia Gap.
Yeah, when we actually performed.
When we do the blindfolded episode,
yeah.
One thing we'll have to do is get Sophia to play something and get some famous pianist and say,
oh, yeah.
play the same thing. And see if you can tell the difference between, ooh. You know, Sophia and Vladimir Ashkenazi.
I like it.
Yeah.
Or we can see if she could, like, imitate Glenn Gould.
I bet she could do that.
She could probably
do it. I bet she could do it.
She can do it. She could definitely do it. For all my friends, Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.